Well, thank you very much, Auntie Katie. Bring it of light, I like that. I might write to Bante, actually. I'm going to tell you another story. I told you a story last time I was here. The Golden Throne is gone. I knew that wouldn't last. They got me behind the podium. And one of the things I've been sort of trying out is walking around giving talks, but I don't suppose that... No. I need to stay in one place. I'm going to tell you a story, and it's my take on the story. I was talking to Aunt Varden over breakfast this morning, and I was saying that Bante and my father are the two men that have had the biggest effect on my life. And I have a lot of gratitude for Bante, a lot of love for Bante, but there's whole sides of Bante that I don't know. And actually the same is true of my father. And I think if you probably look at your friends, your mother, your father, your grandparents, whatever, there'll be whole sides of their life that you're not privy to. I remember going home to visit my father just a few years ago, and they were celebrating, if that's the right word, celebrating D-Day. And my father was actually involved in D-Day, and he talked to me for the first time ever about those incidents over 60 years ago that he'd never been able to talk to anybody about before. He said when he came home from the war, he couldn't talk to my mother. She couldn't understand what he had been through. So for 60 years, he didn't talk about that. 60 years, that an experience like that. So with Bante too, Bante is a complex man. Bante is a multifaceted man. When I was writing this, I thought, oh, Bante, why couldn't you just be simpler? It would be easier. But I'm pleased that at the centre of this rainy season retreat, that we've got a number of different people coming to give their different takes on Bante. And you'll get some sense of him from that, I'm sure. I'm not going to make any jokes about rainy season retreats in Manchester. I've been teased a lot about that. People in Cambridge saying it must be a very, very long retreat. Anyway, I'm not going to say anything about that. So I met Bante for the first time in 1984. I was at Padmaloka, the men's retreat centre, Norfolk Broads. My first big retreat. I was 29 and Bante was 59. Again, interestingly enough, Bante is the same age as my father. My father's name is Dennis as well. It's quite a coincidence. In a couple of months' time, I'm 59 too. I don't know how that has happened, but it has. And I remember going into Bante's study and meeting this old man. This kind of wise old man. I don't know whether I'm wise, but I'm certainly getting older. I went in, I was struck by two things. I was struck by the tartan carpet that is still there in the room, and the heat. It was a summer day, and the heat was really, really cranked up. People said that Bante liked the temperature of India. So we met. And meeting Bante, also the experience of that first retreat, I saw that it was possible to live this life. My experience of Buddhism up until then had been going to a class once a week and going back to my flat, going back to my life and my work and my social life. And it seemed possible to live this life. So I met Bante in his study. And I'd heard that he was a wise man, so I wanted to ask his advice about two personal things. I was cheating in a way. I didn't have the moral courage at that time to change these two areas. I wanted Bante to tell me to do it. So, you know, it would be his responsibility. It would be his fault. I was in a relationship at the time. I'd got a partner at the time, and I think I wanted to get out of that. And I thought, well, Bhante will tell me to go forth. And I was quite taken back when he said to me that it was difficult. If you were in a partnership and you got involved in Buddhism, it could be really difficult for the partner. We could get quite excited about, you know, finding the Dharma, but what about them? And he didn't counsel me to leave them. What he did was he said, spend time with them, be kind, be considerate. Don't just think of yourself, think of them too. I wish I'd taken that advice. So no luck there. So I moved out onto my job. I was working at the DHSS. I was working in supplementary benefits. I don't know whether anybody here remembers supplementary benefits. I'd worked there for 11 years, I think. And it was very kind of stressful, and it was getting worse. And I wanted Bhante to say, leave your job, you know, work for the movement. And he didn't. He said it could be really good at DHSS having a Buddhist. You know, think of think of the positive effect on you know, your colleagues and on the people coming in claiming benefits. So we continued to talk. We had quite a far-ranging conversation. Everything I thought I knew something about Bhante had been there before. And but what kind of really struck me was he opened things up for me. Whenever I've gone with a difficulty, I've got myself into a kind of knot, and I've gone to see Bhante. He's very, very deftly kind of undone the knot and given it me back. He's never been dogmatic. He's never been doctrinaire. He's never said, do this. He's deftly loosened it up for me and given it me back. So I left the study, and I decided that I would leave my partner and I would leave my job. And I'm always grateful to Bhante for not, in a way, taking the responsibility that I needed to take. I needed to realise it was my decision. Sometimes you make bad decisions, and sometimes you make good decisions. But you need to make those decisions yourself. And that was what I got from that afternoon. So that afternoon, I felt that I had found my teacher. I knew what I wanted to do with my life. I felt like I'd left it a little bit late. I was 29, and a lot of the people involved at that time were 19, 20, 21. We could have done with a sort of an older person's group in those days rather than a younger person's group. So I felt I found my teacher, but who was he? Who was Sangharakshita? I'd heard tapes. Do people still listen to the tapes? No! Most of them have been turned into books now, haven't they? But I heard tapes, and they were the old, you know, cassette tapes, some of which had stretched, you know. And this strange, I remember putting the first tape on, this strange Victorian voice came out of the speaker, and very, very kind of clear, very kind of precise, but not a modern voice. But at the same time, saying extraordinary things about changing society, changing oneself. It's quite a kind of contrast, that this voice, and yet this sort of these revolutionary things. So I'm gonna show you a few snapshots. That's not what the screen is for. I'm going to tell you a few stories in this talk. And this is the sketchiest introduction. If you want to know more about Bhante, read Bhante on Bhante. Read Bhante's memoirs. Particularly love The Thousand Petal Lotus. I think that's now The Rainbow Road, isn't it? I think his earlier life has been linked with that. I must have read that book 3, 4, 5 times. Read his memoirs, his poems. His poems are, in a way, also a kind of life story. Whether or not you like his poetry, he makes no claims for it, but it does shed a light on him. And look around you. If you want to No, Bhante, look around. Bhante says that he's a mystery to himself as much as to us. He's a poet, Bhante the mystic, the communicator, the writer, the teacher, the translator, the elucidator, a thinker and a friend. So I'm just going to pick a few things out and talk about those. So he was born not Sangharakshita, but Dennis in 1925 in Tooting in London to working class parents. And if you know anything about his life, you'll know that at 8 years he was diagnosed with a heart condition. At least they thought it was a heart condition. He'd been a very lively child, a very kind of energetic child, and now he was confined to bed for 2 years. I just imagine that. It's a sort of detail you can skip over in his life story, but this small child in bed under the blankets in Eiderdown in those days, in a small house, small terraced house in London. He'd been a keen reader and he became voracious. What comes to mind is this like a cuckoo being fed by these small like parents. His parents having to go further and further afield to find him books to satisfy his appetite for learning, for beauty, for philosophy at eight. I don't know what you were reading. Were you reading Plotinus at eight? I don't know. So summer, winter, in this small room. When Bhante, when it was clear that he had not got a heart condition, he's just rather excitable, he had to learn to walk again. So 2 years must be an eternity for a small child being kept quiet. So the books opening that world. So although he's physically in this small space, the books, his imagination, dissolving away the walls of that small room. And he's read, until recently because of his eyesight, he can't read anymore, but he's read all his life. So now, a teenager, scouring the second-hand bookshops in London, one day, discovering the Diamond Sutra and the Platform Sutra, two Buddhist, well-known Buddhist scriptures, in one of the second-hand bookshops in London. I love those second-hand bookshops too. I don't know whether you do. And opening the Diamond Sutra, once again, the walls disappearing, the narrow life kind of disappearing. And I'm going to read something. This is from Nagabodhi. Is Nagabodhi coming this time? Right. And this is many years later. Bhante's in India with Nagabodhi, giving one of his tours, doing one of his tours, giving many, many talks. This particular night, Bhante sick. So he the talk is postponed or cancelled. And Nagabodhi makes Bhante some warm milk and they sit. They're old friends. They sit and they talk. And Nagabodhi steers the conversation to Bhante's early life. And this is what he says. At the age of 16, he discovered that he was a Buddhist and that he had always been one, which was generally, if enigmatically, used to convey its import. But as Sangharakshita calmly reminisced between sips of warm milk, I began to understand that the experience had been more powerful, more thoroughgoing and unfathomable than I had yet realised. I was to be granted the further realisation that Sangharakshita himself sometimes found the experience baffling. He almost chuckled as he talked of the proverbial flash in which a young lad in pre-war England had sustained a clear and exact vision of the metaphysical core of the Buddhist teaching. Without a shadow of doubt, for so it seemed, he had seen and felt in his own core exactly what the teachings of Buddhism were fundamentally about. But what is most surprising, he continued, is that none of my subsequent spiritual practice, none of my work as a scholar or a teacher, in fact, none of my experience of Buddhism over the past 40 years has made me feel the need to revise or modify that original insight. He cocked his head pensively as a new thought occurred to him. I do realise that is quite a claim to make. To see in a flash to the transcendental heart of Buddhism is one thing, to understand, unfold and embody it quite another. The latter has been the task, the all-consuming commitment that has fully occupied Sangharakshita's life. So at 16, to see that, to have that experience outside time, outside space, I've always wondered where that experience happened, whether it happened in the bookshop. that's rather trivial kind of notion, whether it happened in that room where he'd spent those kind of 2 years. And Bhante's whole life, whole kind of, in a way, mission has been to introduce others to that, to try and build the conditions for other people to experience that too. So Bhante's life was transformed by that vision, rooted in it. His whole life has been the expression of it. And the movement and the order he founded grow out of that vision of the Dharma. Back to Dennis, called up into the army in 1944. He does his basic training. He's very, very good at the Morse code, apparently. Very, very quick. He's in the Signal Corps. His unit is sent to India. Of all places to send the young Dennis, now Buddhist, he gets taken to India. And in his memoirs, he talks about these first beginnings in India, not meeting many Buddhists. Most of the people leading a spiritual life he met were Hindus, and he made very good connections with some Hindus in Buddhism who were really responsive to this young man's spiritual kind of yearning, really encouraged him. The war ends. It's so easy to say that, isn't it? The war ends. The troops start to go home. Dennis decides to stay in India. A little aside now, I was on the ordination course, the men's ordination course last year at Gyuloka, and one of the men I ordained was telling me that when he told his father that he was a Buddhist, his father crawled back into his memory and remembered that there was a Buddhist in the army with him. He'd been stationed in India, and he was in the Signals Corps, and this young man one day didn't turn up at the canteen. They were about to go home, they didn't turn up at the canteen, and the rumour got around that Dennis has gone. And he couldn't believe it, that his dad had been in the Signal Corps with the young Dennis. It seemed such a kind of coincidence. And they were really glad. They were really glad for him. This is what he wanted to do. So Bhante has some experience. He has some experience of, in a way, the futility, the emptiness of some of the Europeans' lives in India at that time, and he goes and stays at Anandamayi's ashram, and in the end he's kind of fed up with both worldly life and organised religion, and he decides with a young Indian friend, a rather hot-tempered young Indian friend, to go forth. So he's 21 at this stage. It's nearly his 22nd birthday. They burn their identity papers. They get rid or really slim down their possessions to just a few volumes. They stop using money. And they head south. They head south to get over to Sri Lanka to ordain as Buddhist monks. Of course, then they meet bureaucracy. They meet civil servants. And no identity papers, they're not coming in. They don't allow them in. So Bunty and his friend stay in South India for a time. There are a few adventures I'd love to kind of go into, but there's no time for that. Eventually, they end up at Ramana Maharshi's ashram. An ashram is a little bit like a monastery, not exactly a monastery, but somewhere where you can go and stay, sit at the feet of the teacher. And Ramana Maharshi was a very famous sort of Indian Hindu saint. Bunty's staying in the cave above the ashram, and one night he has a vision of Amitabha. This vision, like the Rupa on our shrine here, a vision of red Amitabha holding up the lotus. And Bunty takes that as an indication that he should seriously seek ordination into the Buddhist Sangha. By now, that longing is intense. So he and his friend, by now they've got long hair, beards, they dyed their clothes. I don't know whether Bunty's got dreadlocks. It would be quite... we haven't got a picture like that on the shrine, unfortunately. They head up to Sarnath. Sarnath, where the Buddha first taught the Dharma after his enlightenment. They get to the Mahabodhi monastery, Vihara, and the monks take one look at them. And they don't... They certainly are not going to ordain them. They don't want anything to do with them. They're really shocked that these two young men are doing what the Buddha advised people to do. Particularly, really shocked that they've got no money. So maybe they think they're just freeloaders. They want to be monks so that they will be supported. Bunty and his friend, his hot-tempered friend, really, really disappointed. Really disappointed. I think his friend feels a bit more than disappointment. One of the monks at the Mahabodhi temple takes pity on them and tells them about a scholar monk living at Varanasi, Benares, a few miles out of Sarnath, Jagdish Kashyap, very famous Buddhist scholar. So they go directly to see Jagdish Kashyap. He's sympathetic, and he tells them that there is a monk living at Kusinara. Kusinara is where the Buddha passed into Parinirvana. There is a monk called Uchandramani, and Uchandramani may ordain them. Now, Kusinara is 100 miles from Sarnath, and this is the hottest time of the year. So the people who know them, the monks caution not going at this time of year. This is death to go at this time of year. They go. They walk the 100 miles. And Bunty describes this. He talks about walking through the curtain of fire. And they have to get up very, very early in the morning before the sun has risen. And when the sun is up, it's intense. They've got wet towels around their heads. One morning they see a tiger's prints by the railway line, a fresh set of prints where they will be walking. But they get to Kusinara. They survive the journey. It's interesting asking myself, would I have been prepared to walk 100 miles through the Indian sun to get ordination? Yes. So they talk to Uchandramani. He's sympathetic, he wants time to think about it, and he agrees to ordaining them. And Bunty talks about being ordained with his friend, I think on Buddha Day. I think it was Buddha Day morning. I'm not completely sure about that. And the joy, the absolute joy of committing himself to the Buddhist Sangha. In a later publication, Bunty talks about how he mistakenly thought that ordination as a Buddhist monk, that is what made you a Buddhist. That's what represented commitment, decisive commitment to the Buddhist path. And he realized later that that was mistaken. that the ordaining as a Buddhist monk could be as much just joining a religious group as anything else. And it's good to know that, because a lot of Bhante's teaching we just take for granted. It was hard won. It didn't just occur to him. It was hard kind of won. Maybe I'll say a bit about that later. They have more adventures. They go up to Nepal, a few more adventures. Bhante, not very well by this time, settles down for a time with Jagdish Kashyap and parts with his fiery Indian friend. A friend who tried to drown him after an argument once. Anyway, I think Bhante's patience had really got to him and he was going to finish him off. Anyway, he didn't finish him off. So Bhante settles down with Jagdish Kashyap, who is this scholar monk at the Hindu University at Benares. And he said, learning Pali, studying Buddhist logic, these were very, very happy times for Bhante. Very happy times. Jagdish Kashyap decides to go on pilgrimage and take Bhante with him. So they go on pilgrimage to some of the holy places in Bihar. And eventually they go up to a hill station called Kalimpong. And they spend a few weeks at Kalimpong with Jagdish Kashyap, some of his disciples. One day, Jagdish Kashyap says to the young Sangharakshita that he has decided to quit being a teacher and he's going to take a different direction. And he's going to leave Sangharakshita in Kalimpong. And so one morning, he gets into the jeep. His parting words to Bhante are, "Stay and work for the good of Buddhism. The Nuwars will look after you." And then the jeep goes down the hill and Bhante is there, an Englishman in robes, 23. And that's exactly what he does. He follows his teacher's exhortation. He works for the good of the Dharma. He's not sure that he's steeped enough in the Dharma, but that's what he does. And he sets up the YMBA. Not the YMCA, but the YMBA. the Young Men's Buddhist Association. I've got that song coming into my head now. And it's to help young men practice the Dharma and practically help them as well with their studies. And doing this one day, working with the young men one day on English literature, they have to write these sort of praises of poems and other things. Bhante realizes that he's teaching the Dharma through the means of literature. It never occurred to him before that you could communicate the truths of the Dharma through the arts, through literature. Maybe one of our other speakers is going to talk about that more. So he spends his time, he writes articles, poems, he gives talks, he starts two magazines, lots of adventures at this time. He makes friends, and one of the things that comes through in Bhante's memoirs so much is he's always making friends. He's always making connections with people. I mean, weird, sometimes very weird, weird and wonderful people. He makes friends. During this time, he didn't have very much in the way of spiritual friendship, so he made friends wherever he could. And all the time thinking and reflecting on the Dharma. And he embraces, although he's ordained as a Theravada monk, he embraces the whole Buddhist tradition, very, very inspired by the idea of the Bodhisattva ideal. He observes a rainy season retreat, as we are going to do this week. For 3 months of the year, he stays in one place, meditating, reflecting, writing. The other months of the year, very busy communicating the Dharma, but needing that time to refresh himself. And I would really encourage as many of you as possible to take this time, touch something kind of deeper. Bhante founds a Vihara, where the three yonas meet. During this time, China has invaded Tibet, and lots of well-known Tibetan teachers are leaving Tibet and flooding through Kalimpong, some of them settling in Kalimpong. For some time, Bhante has been bothered by a problem, which is how do you go beyond the ego, using the ego? And talking to friends, they suggested that he should be initiated into the sadhana of a bodhisattva. That probably needs unpacking, but that's all I'll say. So he takes initiation from a well-known Buddhist teacher, Chetul Sangha Dorje, a very unconventional Buddhist teacher. He takes the green Tara sadhana. And from that time, Bhante says that he feels that he's kind of guided from a source that is beyond his ego. At this time too, it's quite an intense time for Bhante. He meets Dr. Ambedkar. Dr. Ambedkar was the leader of the Untouchables in India. I don't know whether you know very much about untouchability, but the Untouchables are at the bottom of the caste system. And if you want to improve your condition in Hinduism, you have to stay there. To try and get out of your caste duty is not the answer. Dr. Ambedkar had tried to work within Hinduism to improve the lot of the untouchables. Just their touch would pollute you if you were a caste Hindu. And there are millions of them who found themselves in this particular strata of Indian society. Although it's illegal now, untouchability is illegal, attitudes are so hard to remove, aren't they? Prejudice is so hard to remove. You can change the law, which helps, but actually basic human attitudes take decades, maybe longer, to remove. Dr. Ambedkar was working for many years to try and alleviate the condition of the untouchables, and finally he decides it's impossible. He's going to leave Hinduism and become a Buddhist. In Buddhism, there is no caste, notions of caste. And he talks to Bhante about this, how best to do this. And then finally, Dr. Ambedkar converts to Buddhism with 400,000 followers. Weeks later, days later, many, many more, thousands of people convert to Buddhism. And in Cambridge, slight aside, in Cambridge at Windhorse Evolution, where I work, we have a number of Indian Buddhists who come from that community, who come from the ex-untouchable community. And their parents or their grandparents were there. Some of them were there at the great conversion. And they say that they felt they were getting out of hell. To become a Buddhist was like getting out of hell. Of course, many of them went back to the villages where they still had to struggle with that prejudice. Six weeks after the mass conversions in India, Dr. Ambedkar, who was very, very ill at the time, is dead. Bhante, by an intuition, is in Nagpur very soon after that, maybe the day after that. And this is the heart of the conversion movement in Nagpur, in the centre of India. And Dr. Ambedkar's followers are just lost. The light has gone out of their life. And Bhante spends several days tirelessly consoling, exhorting, inspiring them to continue. That Dr. Ambedkar, their leader, is still alive within their hearts. Maybe it's hard for us as Westerners to get a sense of what this is like. Anyway, I think Nagabodhi is going to talk about India, so this will probably come out in his talk. The Buddhists, the new Buddhists of India, have never forgotten Bhante for this. What he did for them during these days, keeping that new vision alive in their hearts. And for several, he was in Kalimpong for 14 years, and every year he would go down to the plains and he would teach for several months the new Buddhists. He would communicate to them what it was to be a Buddhist. And he says some later time, he hadn't kind of realized before then that Buddhism had an aspect of social change about it. Yes, it was definitely about transforming yourself, transforming your mind, changing your heart, letting go of those habitual patterns. But he hadn't realized it could be a real force for social change in the world. And now he was seeing this. He was seeing how society in India had the possibility of a kind of new beginning. And that insight has been kind of brought into the movement. So it's interesting reading his sort of schedule during these tours down to the plains. He gave hundreds of talks, worked tirelessly. But he was one man. There were very, very few monks doing this in India at the time. And people say, people who knew Bhante at that time said he was remarkable. He was unlike any other Buddhist monk. He would sleep in the fields with them. He would eat whatever they ate. He would drink whatever they drank. He asked for no special treatment as a Buddhist monk. He befriends Dada Rinpoche, who founded a school in Kalimpong that the movement we are still supporting, a school for refugee children, and he takes Bodhisattva ordination. And then something happens. An invitation comes from England. And Bhante's been following the fortunes of Buddhism in England. Tiny movement. And he's asked to go over and to harmonise conflict in the UK Buddhist movement. I mean, it's tiny, you know, it's two tiny little groups arguing about things. He decides to go on a short visit, and Bhante left England in 1944, and he returns in the 60s. And I don't know whether you can imagine what that was like. If you see some old English films of the 40s, people are wearing hats like Apache Prayer. And it's a revolution. It's a completely kind of different world. At this point, we should have the Beatles or the Rolling Stones being played. It's swinging. Swinging Britain, isn't it? And the swinging 60s. I vaguely remember those. The Beatles, LSD, hippies, rock music, sexual revolution, the contraceptive pill, cannabis, an interest in Eastern religion. So people breaking away out of the confines of their parents' sort of conventions. And it must have been a complete, you know, shock to Bhante coming into this world. But he's very, very unflappable, and he works with the Buddhists in the UK. They're rather do a lot, you know, quite narrow. They tend to be middle-aged and middle-class. And rather neurotic, he says. He decides to stay. He does see that there's potential in the UK for Buddhism. So he takes a farewell trip to India to see his teachers, to settle the affairs of the Vihara in India. And a letter comes. The English are so good like this. And a letter comes from the trustees of the Buddhist Vihara where he's living. He's been the kind of head monk there, been very, very popular. Things have really started to buzz at the Buddhist Vihara. And he's teaching the whole breadth of Buddhism. They're not very happy about that. They espouse a rather narrow Theravadan outlook. And what is worse, he's grown his hair a bit. And he's with a friend when the letter comes, and the letter from the trustees says, basically, don't come back. We don't want you back. But you can save face by saying you've changed your mind. And Bhante says to a friend who's with him, do you know what this means? There's no record of what his friend said in response to that. Do you know what this means? And it means a new Buddhist movement. And Bhante is now free to communicate the Dharma in however he wants to. He's free from the restraints of trying to fit in with these two, the staid groups. And this is the birth of the FWBO. Remember the FWBO? Actually, it's not. It's the birth of the Friends of the Western Buddhist Sangha. The FWBO came a little bit later. So Bhante founds the what I'm going to call the FWBO. No wonder we changed it. FWBO. In 1967, tiny beginnings. They used to meet in this little Japanese shop in Monmouth Street in the basement. Bhante had started growing his hair kind of longer. I remember Abhaya, who was around at that time, telling us recently, just a few weeks ago actually, that Bhante used to wear his robes at that time. And then Bhante was going to meet him, I think, in Bournemouth. And he said, be prepared for a surprise. And Abhaya said, are you giving up Buddhism? He said, no. Now, I'm not giving up Buddhism, but be prepared for a surprise. And Bhante comes off the train, and he's wearing a plum-coloured... No, he's not. That's another occasion. He's wearing a T-shirt and jeans. He's not wearing the robes anymore. And he says to Abhaya, so what do you think? And Abhaya said he was thinking, much reduced, Bhante, much reduced. But he said, yeah, fine. So tiny beginnings. In 1968, the order was founded. And Bhante decided to found an order, not a group, not a society where you would pay your kind of membership. There are people who are very fond of joining groups. People are very fond of organizing kind of groups. He wanted a spiritual community. He wanted an order where you committed yourself. You decisively committed yourself to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. What your lifestyle would be would depend. As long as it was an expression of that commitment to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. By this point, he no longer identifies it with being a monk. So you could be a family person. You could live as a monk. You could be single. You could be in any number of different kind of arrangements, lifestyle-wise, and dedicate yourself to the Buddhist path. So the order that he founded was not monastic, and it wasn't lay. It was an equal ordination for men and women. And all the time, Bhante kind of clarifying the principles of the movement, seeing that all later developments of Buddhism came out of going for refuge. The Bodhisattva ideal came out of going for refuge. It wasn't a higher ordination. It was the compassionate aspect of going for refuge, the altruistic aspect of going for refuge. And one of the things that he emphasized, which is kind of unusual, was vertical spiritual friendship. So it was quite a feature in traditional Buddhism that you would have a relationship, you would have a spiritual friendship with your guru, with your teacher. What Bhante wanted to emphasize was friendship between peers, actually. I'm going to kind of read something at the end about that. He was free to experiment. Bante used Western ideas to carry Dharmic messages. He used things like evolution, the individual and the group, Western psychology, all sorts of different things to communicate the essential message of the Dharma to this these people questing for something new. It's a very exciting time, both in Britain and the Dharma, the Buddhist scene at that time, very, very kind of early days. And I would say now, I would emphasise now that these are very, very early days too. It can seem as if the movement is all kind of settled and developed. These are the first moments of the Dharma in the West. You are in at those first moments of the Dharma in the West. In 100 years' time, 200 years' time, 300 years' time, people will look at ours now and say, they were there at the beginning. So what are you going to do about that? So free to experiment. The order steadily grows. Bante takes a sabbatical. Bante leaves the kind of the scene. And order members, the early order members that we've got so much to thank, actually, are suddenly having to find their confidence, find the ability to kind of teach, starting centres, new projects, and all the time friendship deepening and being tested. I remember how much we were tested at the building of this project in Manchester. Yes, all the time, Bante clarifying the principles, the ideals, clarifying views through seminars, through series of talks, through meetings, through books, identifying modern wrong views and how they undermine Dharmic life, the ideals of the new society, right livelihood, which I'm part of in Cambridge, the art and culture, the start of the Indian movement. Bante left India. He worked tirelessly in India, but he was one man. And one man can only do so much. The order now is established in India. There are dozens, if not hundreds, of Indian order members now working with that social revolution in India. The movement grows, the movement diversifies. Handing over, Bante all the time handing over his responsibilities. So, to finish, I mean, I'd just like to say Bante has created a remarkable thing. He's created a community of friends, something that you can kind of touch into, something that you can be part of. And one of the great gifts Bante has given me are my friendships. Is a meaning in my life and my friendships. And friendships now that go back 30 years. I never thought that I would have the depth of friendship that I've got over 30 years. And people seeing me as a young, immature, naive man back in my 20s, growing old, growing kind of old, together. So that is one of the remarkable things we offer, I think. It's not an evening institute, it's a spiritual community that you can kind of be part of. And I'm going to finish with a reading from the Essential Sangharakshita. It just illustrates that. And then we're going to have a little bit of a... It's been advertised as a film. I couldn't claim that, actually. It's rough. And it's probably breaking all sorts of copyright, this film. Because we're using Clear Vision clips. I didn't even ask. I took them off YouTube. And I should be avoiding... Manisha and Pakshapriya and the tea break. So this is what Bante says about spiritual friendship. And I'm reading this to, in a way, illustrate what I'm saying about the importance of spiritual community. And it's important because it communicates the values of the Buddha. But more than that, it's a joy. It's a fantastic thing. Friendship in its own right. Never mind serving a purpose, which it does. So Bhante says, spiritual friendship is a training in unselfishness, in egolessness. You share everything with your friend or friends. You speak to them kindly and affectionately and show concern for their welfare. The development of spiritual friendship is very difficult. Leading the spiritual life is very difficult. Being a Buddhist, a real Buddhist, is very difficult. We need help. And we get that help not only from our teachers, but also from one another. We can't be with our spiritual teacher all the time, but we can be with our spiritual friends all the time, or at least much of the time. We can see them regularly, perhaps live with them, perhaps even work with them. If we spend time with spiritual friends in this way, we will get to know them better, and they will get to know us better. We will learn to be more open and honest. We will be brought up against our weaknesses, and in particular, we will be brought up against our natural tendency to operate in accordance with the power mode. If we have spiritual friends, they will try not to relate to us in this way, and they will expect us to operate in the love mode as well, to relate to them with metta. Learning to relate to our friends in this way, we will gradually learn to respond to the whole world with metta, with unselfishness. It is in this way that spiritual friendship is indeed the whole of the spiritual life.